Good evening, James McCanny here with my Science Hour. It is for March 2nd. Good grief. Oh, man. Already heading into March 2017. Many topics to cover tonight. The main science topic I will be talking about, this is going back a couple weeks, a continuation, large molecules in comet tails. Now, why is this important? I'm going to first give a little innuendo here, and then I'm going to do some other announcements, and then I'll come back to this main science topic. But Comet 67P, the Rosetta mission from Europe, landed on the surface of a comet. And when they put out this information, it is just so horrific. They found a little patch of carbon dioxide ice, they say, on the surface of the comet. Well, it wasn't creating the tail. It wasn't blowing off, or the comet nucleus should look like a steam engine to create the tail that you see, if the dirty snowball comet model were to be correct, which it's not. It's just ludicrous. And then after they said they also detected a little bit of water ice there, but the entire surface of the comet is covered with organic molecules, primarily made up of nitrogen, hydrogen, carbon, and oxygen. Now, these are the building blocks of the nucleotides, which are the basis for DNA. There's basically four nucleotides. And these are very interesting molecules because if you took randomly oxygen, nitrogen, hydrogen, carbon, and you threw them together with some potassium, you would start to build DNA automatically. And it's very interesting the way they're called holes. They're openings in the covalent bonding of these molecules. There's one way they fit together. It's kind of like a jigsaw puzzle that has one solution in three dimensions. And if you start bumping these into each other, eventually they will connect in one and only one way. And so then, once you start building up the DNA, the same thing happens. And this is a point that I was trying to get to a couple weeks ago. But the end result here, now, a comet tail is a factory for large chemicals, chemical structures, molecules, as we call them. Now, let me give you one other little fact here, is when you're studying this, say you're a scientist and you want to know what's in comet tails, the spectroscopy is the tool that you use. Spectroscopy, what does it do? It looks at the covalent bonds between these atoms and between molecules, and it can tell you there's a carbon-oxygen bond, or a carbon dioxide, or a carbon monoxide, or a water molecule. And so you get up to 2-3 atoms in a molecule, you can tell what it is. But when you start getting bigger than that, which is not very big, some of these molecules have hundreds, if not thousands, of atoms built into a long chain structure, like the heavy hydrocarbons, for example, that make up tar, which we find on the surface of comets. You cannot look at that with spectroscopy because all you can look at are these small incremental bonds between just a few atoms. So you can look at that, and what you'll see is carbon dioxide or carbon hydrogen or, say, ammonia, the nitrogen compounds also. You'll see these, but they might be built up are pieces of very much larger molecules. And so with spectroscopy, the tool is very limited. But when they landed on the surface of the comet, they could actually do in situ experiments that allowed them to actually see what was there. So these were big molecular chains based on those atomic species covering in a powder form, in a dust form, covering the comet nucleus. No water, no ice, very, very little carbon dioxide and a very little bit of water ice. But this was not making the tail. When you look at this comet 67P from a distance, it has a voluminous amount of water in the comet tail. So if it's not coming from the nucleus, where is it coming from? But you see how the scientists are lying, trying to maintain that model. And during the Paris Air Show a couple summers ago, the lead scientist from the European Space Agency kind of said under his breath that, although he said it during the interview, and this was summarizing the space agency's results from the Rosetta mission, he said, comets are not dirty snowballs. He said that. What he said literally was that he started out by apologizing. He said, I've written many papers, or he has, he's written many papers that reference the dirty snowball comet model, obviously. And he has believed that for his entire career. And he kind of looked down. He said, we know now that there's not a shred of truth to that, that that model is not correct. Yet the news media and in published papers, the scientists keep promoting this idea of dirty snowball. Well, it's a completely fabricated scientific concept that has no merit. It's been disproven 100 ways to 1. But the point that I'm trying to make tonight is that scientists, when they believe in the dirty snowball comet model, think that all of this material in the tail is coming off the nucleus. And it's not. Nothing, literally nothing, is coming off the nucleus to create a tail. And so all of this material is being built in the comet tail and and here's how it works. You have the electric field of the comet nucleus, the ions that are coming in, the carbons, the hydrogens, the nitrogens, the oxygens, the sulfur, you know, everything else. All the other species are coming in. And typically, they are ionized and then they neutralize sometimes very quickly because the electrons are in the vicinity. They ionize because of solar radiation. But then what happens is they combine. In other words, they have the open valence spaces in their outer electron shell, and they start to combine. So it's no small wonder that you find nucleotides in the tails of comets, plus a lot of other bigger molecules. And like I say, you'll have to excuse my voice a little bit. I'm fighting through some gunk in my head cold, chest cold, etc. But anyway, the end result here is that the comet tail is a cosmic molecular creation device. Now, let's jump up to Venus. We're going to have a inferior conjunction of Venus here on the 25th of March. And so Venus is well known. That goes back to the 1200s when the Chinese medicine first noticed this, that there was a large increase in swine flu, bird flu, and human flu, influenza. This is caused by viruses, when we had the inferior conjunction of Venus. And this is actually published in the modern medical journals. Also is true that we have increased solar sunspot activity during the inferior conjunction of Venus. And this is because Venus is acting like a comet. It's discharging the solar capacitor, and we, Earth, pass through its tail. So no small wonder that we're picking up these viruses from the tail of Venus. And the viruses, what's a virus? A virus is a partially built, randomly built piece of DNA code that is fabricated in outer space. And when it comes in, first it starts in the swine, the pigs, then it mutates whatever goes on in the pig. They actually mutate that virus. Then it becomes susceptible to birds. And that is closer to what humans then are susceptible to. So it's that transformation from swine to bird to human. And so therefore we get a lot of flu activity And this, it'll be in the springtime, so it'll be twice as bad because of the humidity and the, you know, it'll be raining and spring-like conditions for a lot of people. So there'll probably be a pretty good flu season this year. And then, of course, the question comes up, should you get a flu shot? And that's the most ridiculous thing on the planet, because where do they get the flu shot from? They grow the viruses from last year, some flu strain. They put it in a serum and they inject it into you along with mercury, which is deadly poison, and a lot of other things. Mercury destroys your nervous system, and then give you the flu shot. And people have gotten sick from the flu shot itself. But does the flu shot cure flu? No. Does it prevent flu from occurring in your body? No. It's a modern medicine, heebie-jeebie, you know, witch doctor, voodoo. Voodoo is probably a lot more solid than modern medicine. Okay, so anyway, I'll come back to this topic. I got quite a few announcements to make here. First of all, I have a major sale on my webpage. The filter, you can go to my webpage and see, but there's discounts, big, big discounts on all the water filters and water filter accessories. So that includes the water filters themselves and the water filter accessories. That would include the 10 packs of regular standard filters and the Imperial filters. Huge discounts. And I also have packages, I call them Econo packages, where you can get a really big discount from buying a water filter with a 10-pack of filter elements. So look for that on my webpage. And this is going to end this Sunday night. So go there and check this out. The reason it's ending Sunday night, I'll just give you a little clue. I'm finishing up one of a multiple wing generator projects. And the one that I'm targeting right now is a 1 to 3 kilowatt wing generator. So you might say, well, that's not very big. But this is primarily for third world countries, for little farms, etc., out at the end of the power line in third world countries. And it's something that's relatively inexpensive to give these people and electricity very inexpensively. And it is optimized for very low wind speed. In other words, a lot of places in the tropics don't have huge amounts of wind. So you have to capitalize on that. And so this is optimized for low wind speeds. And so also, it's remember I had the Pegasus model, the 12-meter model that I was going to market as the original. That was about a year ago. And I just never, I had development, but I never had enough money to complete that big project. It's a bigger project. And so I've scaled back, and basically the project I'm working on to finalize right now and the plans for this, I'm planning to offer plans for this wing generator to the public. And it's a relatively easy system. It's very forgiving. And so anyway, that's all coming up. So keep an eye out for that. But my point is that the sale going on right now with the water filters is the last push to get the last money together that I need to finish that wing generator project. So help that. You can help me out. You can help the wing generator project out that's nearing completion here, and help yourself out by getting some great water filter products. Okay, just a quick note. I've been talking about Einstein a lot lately on shows and in my paid cast. By the way, this month, the paid cast will be the ongoing series Cosmos, and one of the episodes will be an ongoing series Tesla versus Einstein. And so I just wanted to mention here that when you see a picture of Einstein when he was working at the Swiss Patent Office, where, by the way, that's when he wrote his special relativity paper and basically solved the problem of the Lorentz transformation and resolved it with the Michelson-Morley experiment, which was the experiment that showed conclusively that there was no ether. We did not move through some kind of ether in outer space, and that was the basis for electromagnetic transmission. And so anyway, you see Einstein standing at his desk. And so that just shows you a little bit about the way things were done back then. You did not sit at a desk. You stood at a desk. And so very interesting. A couple other announcements. Mount Etna erupting. Italy has just been rocking and rolling with earthquakes, devastating earthquakes over the last 12 months. And then now Mount Etna erupting. And of course, these events are linked to other wider scale processes, geological processes around the Earth. So a significant event there. Okay, Elon Musk in the news talking about building his gigafactory in Nevada, completely paneled on the roof with solar panels. And they believe they're going to create all of their electricity with the solar panels. But if you're going to run this factory more than 4 or 5 hours a day, then you need vast battery backup to store the power that then will run through the night and later afternoon, early morning, etc. So even in a well-sunlit area like Nevada, the most you're going to get out of these solar panels, and they're not on pivots where they track the sun, the most you're going to get out of this is the equivalent of about 4 hours of sunlight per day. That means that 20 hours per day you have to run off batteries. So you have to have this humongous, humongous battery bank. But of course, the reason I'm reporting on this is because the state of Nevada is giving him immense tax credits. And here's what it amounts to. $725 million in sales and tax abatements, meaning he doesn't have to pay them over 20 years. $332 million real and personal property tax relief over a 10-year period. $195 million transferable tax credits. That means he can take them and move them to other areas, possibly new development, etc. $27 million in payroll tax. In other words, gee, Elon doesn't have to pay state tax at all for personal payroll. And then $8 million for electrical rate over an 8-year period to compensate for electrical rates, anything that he may use. And so basically, in 10 years, tax-free, he's got this place paid for. Out of taxpayer money, in other words. And supposedly he'll employ a lot of people. Well, that's wonderful. But the amount of tax incentives he's getting will literally allow him to build this building for free and operate it for free and tax-free. So I guess it's a good deal if you can get it. But my experience in seeing these kind of deals is as soon as those tax credits are up, the guy is up and gone. He's going to someplace else where he can get a better deal and doesn't have to pay the taxes. So they use the tax advantage as long as they can and then bolt. Anyway, quick announcement here. March 25th, inferior conjunction of Venus. Get ready for the flu. Don't go around kissing frogs or other funny animals or maybe even babies, because the March 25th, this is when we will start to pick up those viruses in the tail of Venus and begin a springtime session of influenza. And on the 7th of April, we're having an opposition with Jupiter. In other words, Jupiter will be in alignment with Earth and the Sun, and the famous Jupiter winds that I've defined. Now, it was funny. I was on John Moore's show yesterday, and I've been busy with this wing project, with other projects, with other things that I'm doing, web page upgrades, various things like that. And so I hadn't been looking at, you know, solar system configurations. So a caller called into John Moore's show and asked about the Jupiter winds coming up this month. And it happens about every 13 months is the period between Jupiter winds. That's how long it takes us to get around to see Jupiter again. But and also the 11th is the full moon, so we have a number of alignments here that could add up to having some serious effects. One, during the inferior conjunction of Venus, and we also have the new moon around the 28th of March. So around the 30th of March, we'll have the new moon passing, so that inferior conjunction of Venus could be significant relative to weather and winds. And then, as I say, up around April 7th, the inferior conjunction or the opposition with Jupiter and the Jupiter winds that we experience on a basically a yearly time scale. Okay, the following was sent in by a listener, and what it amounts to is the United Nations examining the world water situation, and this is something I've been talking about for a long time. First of all, they sent out scientists all over the world, geological surveys, etc., to find out all of the water resources in the world, every drop of water, whether it falls from the sky, whether it's in the ground, whether it's in rivers or waterways or spillways or wetlands or whatever. And so scientists went out and for their meager salaries did all this information, got this information, sent it back to the government, and this all goes up the chain. The UN, the United Nations, is a World Banker front organization to control wars, to control water and resources, to allow the United States to go in and be the spearhead for International Monetary Fund loans to countries that they can never pay back and basically rob the resources from those countries. So anyway, this is a report on water, and I want to read it to you because it's very telling. Let me see if I can pull this up here. What I'm going to do is I'm going to read the from the table of contents. And it says, these are titles. For a Water Secure World, Directions for Actions. Let's see. Yeah, I'm still... okay, so let me pull this up. Participatory Institutional Mechanisms. Here's number three, fresh water as a scarce commodity. Now, this is where they come in. Fresh water as a basic need. Incentives are needed. Oh, we have to be incentivized. Political will is needed. Oh, we have to get the governments involved, don't we? Governments are key actors. This is number five. Behavioral change. Your behavior has to change. Beyond Dublin and Rio de Janeiro, those were where major international meetings were held, also including climate change, and no more business as usual. Oh, everybody's got to buckle down and change. Okay, so then we go to two. Chapter two, the water crisis, where we are today and how we got there. And the gloomy arithmetic of water. Okay, let's make this clear. We live on a planet that is three quarters covered with water. We don't have a water problem. We have a water management problem. And so everything they're doing is trying to make you believe that there's a water problem, and there's not. We have industries like the EPA that allows it plans on pollution. It allows levels of pollution that are cumulative and not acceptable. So anyway, then this study goes on. Inspiring but difficult goals. Why integrated water resource management. Ooh, integrated. That's a big word for feel-good management. How to achieve it. International waters and national sovereignty. Oh, we have to have governments in controlling international water and with national sovereignty. And then participation is the key. Isn't that sweet? We all got to participate and do our job to understand that water is a scarce commodity, and then they're putting it in your brain that, okay, now here we get down to W. Okay, let's go to 4, chapter 4, framework for action, necessary steps for turning the vision into reality. Water management is everyone's responsibility. The scale of the challenge and funding requirements. Oops, we need funding, we need management, we need little peons all over the place with little rule books in control running out, giving you fines for doing bad things with water. When it's the international corporate monsters that you have nothing to do with. Okay, defining the roles of different actors. Oh, isn't that a cute little title? Promoting innovation. Oh, we're going to promote innovation. And then a summary of key recommendations, some concrete next steps. Then here we go in the appendices, World Water Commission for the 21st Century. Oh, now we have a water commission, International Water Commission. Isn't that special? So you see where this is going. The United Nations study on water, and this is designed, it's called Water, it's a World Water Vision Commission report. Well, vision for water, life, and the environment. Doesn't that just sound so smooth? You just can take that like syrupy, sweet cough syrup. Wow. These people have an agenda. And water, taking water away and controlling water is primary. They already control oil, the major source of energy. They already control electricity through centralized power distribution, where they don't allow you, the individual, to have water or energy of your own. And now, where is it? What state was it? Oklahoma, that basically nationalized home energy, that said that the power company has to install it and manage it? Isn't that special that you cannot have your own home energy? I think they're getting ready for the time where the public simply has the ability to create their own energy, and they don't want that. Because let's face it, we all live by electricity. And, well, let's just put it this way. Everything that I do is targeted towards helping the world in water filtration, in creating weather systems, weather manipulation, and I'm the one that really worked and invented this process for weather manipulation to help bring water by nature's method to drought-stricken areas of the world. And it's now being used against the public to create droughts, to create flooding, to create climate change, to create horrific situations for some people in the world, climate manipulation to allow companies like Monsanto to spray aluminum into the soil so that other plants besides their aluminum-resistant plants can grow. Oh, my God. Yeah, this is all going on, folks. And then my other project, the Wing Project, is to give power back to the people, to give energy on a personal level back to the people and all the way up to the central power companies to replace them. So they're already fighting the war. They're already heading off at the pass progress that would give people the control of water. In my book that's now quite a few years old, a lot of you have that, is called Water, I talk about the Declaration of Water Independence, where water independence is literally an inalienable right. An inalienable right is something that comes as part of the natural law, and the UN does not believe in natural law. They believe in United Nations law, where the United Nations controls and says who gets to get water and who pays or pays a carbon tax. Canada is in the middle of this, and believe me, if the old Hillary Rodham would have gotten elected, the United States would have not only increased taxes, but you would also have a carbon tax piled on everything you do, from your baby breathing up to your large corporation using electricity. There would have been a carbon tax put on everything. And it would have just buried this country. Obama, I mean, did a great job of doubling the national debt in his 8 years. Bush Jr. raised the national debt from a very small amount, very manageable amount, to humongous, like $10 trillion. Obama doubled that, more than doubled it. And now Trump is beset with trying to bring this country back to life with a $10 trillion debt. And nobody can exactly figure out where $10 trillion went. When, mind you, you were paying taxes all this time. In spite of all the money you paid for taxes, $10 trillion in debt got piled on top of all of it. So anyway, I wanted to read that little United Nations water study to show you how they're just, they're out there helping you. This is for the people. Yeah, right, buddy. The sooner they kick the UN out of New York, just have nothing more to do with those monsters, the better. If the United States pulled out, they would just go away. And they really have never done much in terms of what their stated goal is. That's keeping world peace. There's more wars now than ever. The Obama and the Bushes through the Clinton administration, back through George Bush Sr., all we've had is hundreds, not a few. These are not ones that you see readily. Hundreds of little skirmishes, wars, policing operations all over the world. And these are designed to rape these countries of their national resources, force them into International Monetary Fund loans. And you see what happens to countries that resist this, like Venezuela and Ecuador and other countries. They get stomped on economically, and they're fighting for survival. But in the midst of it, they are surviving and they're finding new ways to deal. And that's why the United States has lost an incredible amount of respect around the globe. People hate the United States. So when you go places, they hate the people of the United States. Why? Because you represent all the bad things that have happened to them. You know, their poverty is based on U.S. policy. Just a quick note. Apparently, my dissertations have had an effect. I don't know if it was a month or two ago, maybe 3 months ago, I started hammering on this idea that SSL, Secure Socket Layer, which is based on broken RSA codes, would be necessary for secure websites. And I explained why I personally don't have one, and that it's a scam to make all the web pages pay for this SSL security certificate. That's where you see the little HTTPS there, the little S. And it's based on secure socket layers based on RSA codes, which are based on prime numbers, which is a broken system. But anyway, the effort to try and force web pages to get this has finally been dealt with. And exactly what I said, web pages are finding out they don't need SSL security because they don't take information. My web page does not take information from you. You don't fill out information when you go to my web page to buy. You go off to a secure site, and that's where all of the security is taken care of. And so anyway, luckily, or I don't know, maybe just by force, I started calling up some ISPs, and this word got back out into the industry that this is a big scam and that the vast majority of web pages do not need SSL security. And so at any rate, if you go to a web page and fill out information of some kind, then yeah, you would want SSL security. Or some type of security. And frankly, SSL is the worst kind of security because it's broken. But at any rate, my efforts to stem that scam really had an effect. So I just want to announce that. I'm very happy to announce that one thing I did had an effect. Regarding the moon landing, or the alleged moon landing of Apollo, and by the way, Elon Musk says he's going to be within a year offering rides to people to go around the moon and come back. Well, good luck, Elon. Maybe somebody didn't tell you about radiation belts. But I have a plan, and I'd like to see this carried out. let's take all of the astronauts that allegedly went to the moon and bring them into a courtroom setting under oath with lie detectors and have them respond. Did you take these pictures? Now, first of all, we know all of the pictures of the moon landing are fake. All the video, all the photo footage, everything they showed us and continue to show to this day is fake footage. It was done in a warehouse, in a stage setting on Earth. So it's all fake. So let's bring the astronauts first into a setting where they have to be subjected to rigorous questioning, legal setting where they are under oath, and say, did you take these pictures on the moon? And have them answer. And when they, and see, NASA has protected this through all of these decades. And then, did they take the photos? And did they, in fact, then go to the moon? Because they would have to say no under oath that they did not take those photos or videos. And then the question arises, did you go to the moon? And they're going to have to say no. And then they might say, well, somebody went in our place because they wanted us safe. Oh, well, who did go to the moon then? Let's talk to those people. Oh, well, nobody knows. Yeah, because nobody went to the moon. At any rate, that's something that should be in place. And instead of these little yo-yos like Phil played or ding-dongs like that running around the internet, you know, little old Phil wasn't even born when they were going to the moon. You know, he was, you know, picking his nose in the back row of third grade or something. And, you know, so, you know, how does somebody that wasn't even around come out and tell you that, oh, for sure NASA went to the moon? That's just bullshit. Well, excuse me. That's you know what. okay, so that's one issue. And then all this information about exoplanets. Did NASA discover seven new planets? And no, they didn't. This is once again secondary and interpretation of data. What they saw was a star, which is a variable star, which has very low output, every now and then dipping with the light output of the star. So they interpret that as being planets crossing across the disk. Okay, well, that could be, but maybe it's not. Maybe it's just the star having a variable lapse in energy output or some other issue going on. And then they say there were seven of them. So they take this dipping of the light curve coming from the star, they put it into a computer, and then they say, well, these objects are within very close, I mean, nose to nose with this star. If you looked on a scale of our solar system, they would be way, way inside the orbit of Mercury. So not exactly where you would call a habitable zone. These are right nose to nose to this star, and the star is very weak. So this is a bunch of hooey. NASA didn't discover planets. They're making this up, is all I can tell you. It's more never a straight answer from NASA. And so just an incredible amount of lying, literally lying, and my estimation was that they were doing this to get funding. By the way, to my list of fake news, Google and I guess I did mention Wikipedia, but I will be listing that list of fake news sources on my website. I've been very busy lately, hadn't had time to do that yet. Oh, and by the way, regarding this moon going to the moon thing, the CIA is busy creating fake news sites and people. And they're coming out of the woodwork. You're going to see them all over. There's a guy on the internet now being promoted, and he's saying that NASA has never gone into space, that rockets are faked, that the space shuttle is fake, that everything NASA does is fake. It's staged. Well, this is a fake news. And so anyway, it's easy target because clearly the space shuttle goes into space. He's saying the space station is fake. No, the space station is real. And all this low Earth orbit stuff is real. And the rockets going off, the Saturn V rockets were real. They put people into low Earth orbit, but they never went to the moon. They never went out of low Earth orbit. But they have this joker running around saying everything NASA does is fake. Well, you see, now they can point to those people, and that's the fake news. They're creating fake news sites to take the place of legitimate criticism of NASA. So they're controlling both sides of the dialogue. So you're going to see a lot more fake news sites popping out all over the place. Okay, on to the next topic. Couple quick comments. The Bundy trial continues from the 2014 issues. And so anyway, with the BLM, which wasn't even in existence when those people started raising and grazing their cattle on that land. So anyway, check that out. I'm sure there's a lot of news coverage on that. And just one last quick comment. The hatred towards Americans when you go to other countries, nobody in the United States is talking about this, that, you know, the things, the policies, the foreign policy, the things that are going on in the United States cause a lot of hatred in other countries. And, you know, this has gone on unabated. So there are things we can do. And in fact, you know, immigration is something where most people really would like to live in their own country. I mean, I talk to a lot of people. They don't want to move to the United States necessarily. Some do. But the vast majority want to simply live in their own country. But they are in such terrible condition because of U.S. foreign policy and the international banks, which are spearheaded by the United States, and other military conflicts, the majority of which is performed by the United States. And so the hatred towards Americans, when you go to, you know, Cancun or some you know, foreign resort and stay in a five-star hotel, you don't see that. But I don't stay in five-star hotels. I go out and mingle with the public, and that's where I see it. And really, people are very friendly. I get treated very nicely when people look at me and talk to me, and they just realize that I'm... But then when you talk to them, you realize that their lives have been drastically affected by American policies. So... just want to, as we move into a new future, as America rebuilds, it's a case where if America is not a strong country, then we can't help other people. It's like when you're in an airplane and the oxygen masks drop down, they say, put yours on first before you help somebody else. You have to be healthy before you can help somebody else. And that's the case with the United States. We have become desperately poor, literally been driven down to third world country status. And so at any rate, just be aware of that, that in making our own selves great, that we're also going to help other countries, because our economy is going to be reflected in what goes on in other countries. I also see Trump as being surrounded by a lot of people who have other agendas. So he's struggling to make good decisions, but unfortunately, I don't think he understands a lot of what's going on in foreign countries. And also, I see that he's not understanding what's going on with NASA. He's talking about maybe NASA going to take manned missions to deep into space, etc. There again, he doesn't understand the issues with radiation and the fact that NASA cannot get into space. They can't get a mouse into space now. Everything they have is on the drawing board, and anything they have is way behind schedule and over budget. Okay, enough of that. So off into outer space to talk about big molecules. So let us discuss how these molecules form. When you say take benzene, for example, let's take a hydrocarbon, and look at the chemical formula. It is C6H6. So all of the carbons are combined into a six-sided structure, and then every one of the carbons is attached to a hydrogen atom. So it's a completely stable molecule, and it has one way to form. So once you get the basic six-sided structure of carbon, which is a natural closed form of carbon, and you have one opening which is occupied by the hydrogen, or let's take something as simple as water, H2O. So you have an oxygen that's, and by the way, the angles between the hydrogen bonds are 120 degrees in benzene. With water, we have H2O, and they form at a specific angle also. So you have an oxygen atom, which has two available source spots in its outer valence electron shell, and two hydrogens fill it up. So water is extremely, extremely stable molecule, which is good, because but it forms readily. So when you have hydrogen and oxygen in outer space and you bring them together in a comet tail, it's very easy to see how water forms from the basic atomic structure. Hydrogen, a couple hydrogens, and an oxygen. And so, okay, let's go up to larger molecules. And I could go on and list these all day long, all the way up to the very large hydrocarbon chains or the nucleotides or the other more complex molecules. But these, in a random setting where you're just bringing these atoms in and you give them an environment to clone, to join, you have the ability to form all of these atoms in abundance. And that's what you see in a comet tail. So when the comet nucleus discharges the solar capacitor, according to my plasma discharge comet model, the electron beam comes out from the sun, because that's the primary charge carrier in the discharge, the electrons, because they have a lower charge to mass ratio. They come and they hit the comet nucleus, causing it to charge up to a negative potential. So that is a point source of negative charge. That begins to draw in the positively charged ions, the hydrogens, the oxygens, the nitrogens, the carbons, the sulfur, the everything else and that is available in the region of the solar system. And as these come in, they start to join in a very natural setting. So they're being brought in as the density becomes much higher. They form chemical species. And of course, very little of this ever gets to the comet nucleus, because once they form, a lot of times they neutralize. Once they get down close to the comet, there's this big cloud of electrons. So what happens to all of this? It becomes neutralized. And then if the comet nucleus does not have sufficient mass, these get carried out in the solar wind, and scientists mistakenly call these neutrals. Well, they are neutral. They're neutral atoms. But they're not being generated at the comet nucleus. They're a formation, this process that I'm telling you, they're formed. They come in, they're still ionized, they come in towards the comet nucleus. There's a sea of electrons, they become neutralized, and they float out in the solar wind. So that is what has fooled scientists, comet scientists, into believing that they're seeing drifting molecules from the so-called dirty snowball. But when you look nose to nose to the nucleus, there's nothing on the nucleus. There's no water. There's no ice. There's there's some there's some organic chemical molecule chains that have built up in the form of dust on the surface, or there might be tar burned onto the surface, hydrocarbons. But none of that is coming off to form the tail. And so scientists, by not really telling the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, are in a sense lying about the scientific results and trying to maintain this dirty snowball comet model. But the reason this is important is because Earth acts like a comet, and there's this idea that comets somehow brought life to Earth. Well, if comets brought life to Earth with a dirty snowball comet model where they were locked in from primordial times, where did the comet nucleus get the nucleotides and the DNA and everything else? Well, it just puts it off into never, never land, and they never have to answer the question, where was it originally, the molecules, where were they originally formed? They don't have to answer that question. And of course, since they hide behind the big brick wall that is NASA, nobody else can ask them these questions either. Okay, so why is this important? Because Earth is a comet, acting as a comet, discharging the solar capacitors. So we are bringing in these molecules all the time also. And once they get into Earth, then they have the ability to grow and build up also. But you have a continual rain of hydrocarbons of water, and this has been measured. It was first measured by Lou Frank back in the 1980s. He directly measured the water signature on the surface upper atmosphere of Earth, and he measured these as big, broad patches of water up in the upper atmosphere. And of course, the first thing, there was no reason for any of this to be there. And so what they said is, oh, maybe these were microcomets coming into Earth, and when they hit the atmosphere, they melted and caused the water. Well, no, microcomets a couple inches across would maybe distribute water among, maybe for a 1 foot by 1 foot area, not hundreds of square miles. So once again, my plasma discharge comet model explains where this water comes from. It comes from outer space because we literally have connections, and they look like a leech, basically connected to Earth, if you could draw a picture of them, kind of like a leech type of shape, or a comet tail type of shape connecting to the Earth's upper atmosphere. And then these electrically touch down, they go all the way from the ionosphere down to the surface of the Earth and can drive water, sometimes extreme amounts of water, into weather systems in the troposphere where we live, into hurricanes, into tornadoes, and into thunderstorm systems. So sometimes you'll see, and I've tracked this, I don't know, hundreds of times, where you'll see dry air from the Pacific Ocean, and you get out to the Midwest in the United States or some other place like Europe or Russia, etc. And all of a sudden, clouds form and it rains, but that water did not come across the land from a great distance. It did not come from any oceanic body or sea. It did not come across, and by the way, these you hear atmospheric rivers, that's a term I coined in my weather book. And so it's that's something that's been stolen recently, terminology, and being used in the popular press when they're talking about these the end of the drought and these big flood systems that are coming into California. That was my term in my weather book. You can look that up and check that out, but just noting that for the record. When the ancients talked about the rain of brimstone and fire coming in from the upper atmosphere, they were talking about the passage of a large comet, and we were going through the comet tail. So the brimstone, the pieces of rock that rained in through the atmosphere from outside, were in fact meteorites from the comet tail. And when they hit the atmosphere, they, of course, lit up, became extremely hot. And the naphtha, the burning naphtha, were the hydrocarbons coming into the atmosphere amongst the all of the other organic chemicals that were being built in outer space. But the hydrocarbons would burn. They hit the oxygen in quantity. Then the meteorites started them on fire. So there was literally a burning up in the sky, in the atmosphere. And the ancients saw this, and then the rain of stones and rocks came down and was very damaging. It killed a lot of people. And the ancients talk about this. This is 100% evidence that the time when this was happening, for example, Sodom and Gomorrah, those days, that this was the earth passing through a comet tail, and the rain of naphtha, brimstone and fire is what it's called. And so these are natural phenomena caused by earth passing through a comet tail. There's, you know, if you understand what comets are. But, of course, standard science feigns away from talking about any of this. The reason I'm talking about this is because it's a very essential part of our earthly process and all the other planets. When the comet Schumacher-Levy 9 came into the region of Jupiter, and this is in my work also in my books, they talk, this was about 1995 or 6, I believe, that it broke into 21 pieces. So here you have like a little string of pearls, little comets, and they are water comets out in the general solar atmosphere or solar environment out beyond Jupiter, they are water comets. As soon as, and they knew because of the trajectory that they were going to crash into Jupiter. So everybody was watching. In fact, NASA purposefully did not watch because they didn't think anything would happen. At the time of the impact, they were going to hit on the nighttime side of Jupiter. I can tell you that all the people in Russia, because I happened to be working with Russian scientists at that time, everybody, every instrument in Russia was trained on Jupiter. X-ray detectors, everything. And as those 21 pieces came in and hit Jupiter, they exploded with tremendous, tremendous amount of energy. And that's because they discharged the Jupiter capacitor that's caused because Jupiter is a small star and supports its own fusion proton wind-supported capacitor. And so when these discharged, they literally blew up, just like a bug killer would basically turn a bug to smoke. The same thing happened, and they could see the reflected X-rays off of the moons of Jupiter to the extent that they could actually calculate the energy release. And they said this was nuclear in nature, and the explosions were due to the fact that these were electrical discharges. But the key point is that when they were outside the realm of Jupiter, they were water comets. The tails were water. And as soon as they came into the realm of Jupiter, they became sulfur dioxide comets because sulfur dioxide is the majority chemical species that's around Jupiter. That's why Jupiter is red. That's why Io, the moon of Jupiter, the first big moon, is primarily sulfur dioxide. It's red, very volcanic. But anyway, this is all related, this is all easily explained by my plasma discharge comet model. And the Russians came out with a public international announcement that the dirty snowball model was dead. There was, you know, and NASA continues. Here we are in 2017, literally 20 some years later, and they're still putting it on the European Space Agency, etc. Okay, well, anyway, that's hopefully that gives people a better idea about large molecules in outer space with comets, with Earth and the planets, Jupiter, other planets, etc. And just as a last note, NASA finally had to admit that Mercury, Venus, Mars, and Pluto have comet tails. And the reason that's significant is because they do not have magnetic fields. So these would not be so-called magnetic tails. So, they have no way to explain why this is happening. But go to my webpage, jmccsci.com. Remember, the big sale continues till Sunday night, and you'll help me out. This is going to help with some monetary efforts going to finish this one-wing project. You're going to help a lot of people out in third-world countries, and this will get you a day closer. Very soon, the plans that I'll be releasing, so you can actually purchase plans and build a 1 to 3 kilowatt generator and for yourself that are very efficient at low wind speeds, something that's not true of the commercial models available today. This is Jim McCanny. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.